once you get going and build that team, the next deals just flow so much easier from all aspects. I'm not saying this is an easy business, but it definitely gets easier as you go because you build up that team, you know what to expect. For the most part, you know, real estate definitely throws you wrenches at you all the time.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I am your host, Justin Dixon, and excited to have Sean Winslow on the pod today. Sean grew up in Vermont to entrepreneurial parents and family. He started out his entrepreneurial journey with a lemonade stand and knew that if he wanted things in his life like a bike, he needed to work hard to get it. Didn't go down the entrepreneurial route right away. He went into finance and investing after going to college and before moving into acquiring some small three family, they call it in Boston, triplex, up to 20 units in the first year or so before jumping into larger deals. His first large deal was almost 200 units. We talk a lot about his mindset and how he made that shift from, you know, growing up in an entrepreneurial household to going to school and kind of working the 9 to 5 and then shifting out into now being full-time real estate investor. So stay tuned to the pod and let's welcome it into the show. Awesome, man. Sean, welcome to the show. Great to have you on the pod, man.
Hey, Justin, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. Yeah, no, let's jump right in. So, you know, give us a quick overview of who you are and what you're up to in real estate, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, man. I'll take it back a little ways just to kind of give the listeners a feel for why I'm doing what I'm doing now. Yeah. So I'll take it way back, actually. So when I was a kid, I grew up in a small town in Vermont to a family of entrepreneurs, business owners. You know, back then they called themselves small business owners, not entrepreneurs, but I digress from that. Anyways, so like that's what I was conditioned from a young age, right? So, you know, I had the lemonade stand. And then I had, you know, lawn care, mowed lawns. You know, I'm from the Northeast, so also had snow removal.
Yeah.
And I just had that, you know, entrepreneurial spirit of like, all right, if you want to make some money, like I wanted a bike, I'm out a new mountain bike. And I was told like, I got to pay for half at least. That's when I started mowing. So I had that, I'm mowing lawns. So that's when I really started, you know, just changing the mindset of like, you got to go out, make the money, the term, you know, take the bull by the horn. So
right.
I was conditioned in that way. And then I think what happens to a lot of people is, you know, you go to high school, you get told you need to do well there so you can get into a good college. And that's what I did. Got to a good, went to a college and then was told I need to, you know, do really well so I can get a good, you know, W-2 9-to-5 job.
Right.
And that's what I did. Studied finance, ended up at a large investment firm in Boston and worked there for, you know, around 7 years. So traditional investments, very different from what we're about to talk about, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, it was great. I love investing. You know, I love helping people build wealth. But at the end of the day, I just realized what I was offering at that firm was not the most, you know, one, tax efficient, cost effective, you know, or just, it just was not the best way to grow wealth. It was great for the portfolio managers, fund managers, you know, sales guys, of course, they made, you know, and I just, it just didn't sit well. So I knew I needed to make a change. And before I made the change, I was to realize that change shouldn't just be like, you know, I want to do a different job to make money. It should be like, no, how can I create something that supports a life that I want to have? So I thought about what are the two things I want in life? Well, obviously everyone knows it costs to do things. So you need some type of income. But the other thing I wanted was time. I wanted to be able to do the things I wanted with the people I wanted when I wanted. And so I was like, okay, think about people who have that already. And so I thought of some people, friends, former colleagues, former, you know, family members, friends, people, just acquaintances, right?
Yeah.
And all the ones that had that dynamic, like enough money to do some awesome things and enough time to do them when they wanted, they were all in real estate. So
got it.
That's why I want to make the change. And I can stop here if you want to ask any questions or I can continue on.
Yeah, no, we can unpack some of that. And I'm curious kind of a little bit about, you know, your upbringing and kind of having those entrepreneurial parents and family members. Like, how did you kind of shift from, okay, if I want a bike as a kid, I need to have a lemonade stand and or mow X amount of lawns to get the bike, right? To then, you know, you kind of got I'll use brainwashed when you went to high school and college, because that's like what everybody, you know, thinks, right? I grew up in a, you know, different environment. Both my parents worked, you know, for the man. And, you know, the goal was to work for 30, 40 years, have enough money in your 401k so that you hopefully can retire comfortably, you know, at the end of that, right? And so you kind of had the ideal scenario where you had entrepreneurial parents that kind of, you know, figured it out. Then you went to college and then you got the job. And then when did you kind of think about, okay, was it a moment, or like, how did that kind of mindset shift going back to like, okay, I need to do something different with my time and my effort?
Yeah. It was when I, you know, there was a couple things. One was I just felt like I wanted more, you know, and I didn't want to work for someone else's dream. I wanted to work for my own dream. And don't get me wrong, like there's some people that love that type of security, that type of job, but that just was not me. And I just felt like, you know, I was just not getting enough out of life, just, you know, clocking in, clocking out every day. And it brought me back to my younger years when it was, that was how much fun that was, because I would get friends to mow their lawns and I would take, you know, a cut of what they made, you know, and it was just like game, man. It was just like, it was fun. It was exhilarating. And I was in control, you know, it's cliched, but I was essentially in control of my destiny, right? So that just kind of invigorated me. And then on the other side of it, it brought me back to something my grandfather told me, who was an entrepreneur, successful entrepreneur. And that was, and he loved the stock market. So it's kind of funny that I got into real estate, because he was a big stock market proponent. But he told me that all the real estate he owned, because he also owned real estate, but that would be his retirement, that it would pay for his retirement. So those two things kind of clicked. And I was like, this is what I need to do. So that's kind of how the mind shift changes. And also like just seeing the people I worked with, like, that's not the future I wanted, right? Like, yeah, they were making decent, pretty good money, right? But it was like, they're always nervous. Like, am I hitting my numbers, my sales goals? If from the fund management side, am I like, is it performing well enough? They're just beholden to essentially the man, like you said, and they could get, you know, let go, fired at the drop of a dime, you know?
Yeah. I love when people talk about 9-to-5 job career as secure. And, you know, for those of you who don't know, I've been in recruiting for 16 years and worked for small and large companies and, you know, publicly traded and private companies. And when the company needs to make their number, you are just a line item on a spreadsheet and an expense, you know, even if you're in sales. So, you know, I've seen a lot of great professional, hardworking people get told they are out of a job because the company needs to survive and needs to thrive. And unfortunately, it's at their expense. So you can be, you know, the hardest working employee, show up every day to work, don't take vacations, don't take sick days. And you could come in one day and be like, you have 2 weeks to find a new job. And so it's to your point, like, and you're always chasing the dream, chasing the number, especially if you're in a, you know, business development, you know, environment, there's always a quota to hit or a target. So it's not as secure as people feel or think that it is. And sometimes being an entrepreneur, yes, it's very risky and, you know, it's a different kind of risk and stress, but, you know, I'd rather work 100 hours for myself than 40 hours for somebody else, right? So let's talk a little bit about kind of the transition from when you were, you know, in the finance world, working for a company to jumping into doing what you're doing now. And so I guess talk about kind of the point at which you kind of made the break. And then, you know, what did you do leading up to that to kind of set yourself up for that kind of, I'm going to quit my 9-to-5?
Yeah. So it's funny because I was still partially conditioned to, you know, educate yourself like formally before you did anything. So the first thing I did was, you know, I reached out to friends that were already in the real estate industry and they all referred me to Boston University's real estate finance program. Okay. And this is a night program. And again, they were in real estate, but it was a 9-to-5 job, right? They're working for private equity firms. And so it was still, they were still in that mindset too. So I took that. It was like a year and a half program, I want to say.
Okay.
Partially, you know, it was accredited. And it was don't get me wrong, I do not regret it. It was awesome. I learned, like, all the teachers were people that were currently practicing, you know, real estate investing. So it's not like you're learning for someone who's doing it like 5-10 years ago.
Right.
So I learned a lot of great stuff, but at the same time, it kind of slowed me down. I could have found a more practical way to do it, right? And again, it's funny because when I completed that program, I was still in the mindset, okay, let's go work for a private equity shop, right? But still, like, let's go get a 9-to-5, but instead of in, you know, financial services, let's do it in, you know, real estate. But the funny part is that towards the end of it, I met this kid that was also in that this program. And he told me, he's like, yeah, I work for this syndicator out of Boston, but I'm trying to get out of that. You know, I might go get my master's. I want to work for, like, you know, private equity. And I was like, what's a syndicator? Like, I hadn't heard that term before. I knew what private placements were because we offered them at the firm I worked for. But the word syndication, I was like, what is that? And he goes, oh, it's like where you, you know, private placement, you pull money. Oh, I was like, I know what that is. He's like, yeah, you can do it with real estate. And he says, you pull people's money together and you go buy big properties, right? And it was funny. He was taking this finance program to get out of that. And now I wanted to get into that. I was like, yeah, that's right. Exactly what I want to do. And that's what I need to do. And so then I was kind of brainstorming, figure out like, how do I do this? Because I can't go do that and work for my firm because I was licensed at the time, you know, Series 766. Yeah. So, you know, conflict of interest and I can't raise money for them and then raise money for myself. Just can't do that, right? So I was like, well, how can I, like, I need a little bit of a runway. I can't just, you know, stop cold turkey here, my job and my income. So then I figured, let's just start buying small multis.
Okay.
So I did that. And it's just, man, it's the power of, like, I'm sure listeners, if you're familiar with this industry, you've heard the phrase, the law of the first deal. And if you haven't, it simply just means is like, once you do your first deal, like it just seems like the next ones just flow. Like the first one's the hardest to get done. And it's so true because I bought a 3-unit, so a triplex, or if you're from Boston area, they call it 3-family. So I bought a 3-family. It's funny. There's so many terms in real estate and they all just mean the same thing. So bought a 3-family, bought it with a buddy. And then I bought that was in July, and then August of that year, I bought a duplex that I house hacked. And then probably 3 months after that, I bought another 3-family. And then 4 or 5 months after that, we cash out refied the first property we bought and bought another 3-family. And then after that, we bought from that property. This is a tip too. Whenever you're buying something, ask, like, whether you're buying direct to seller or from a broker agent, ask, like, does this seller have any more properties?
Right.
I did that and they ended up having 14 more units. So then I ended up 2 months after that closing, buying the rest of his portfolio at 14 units. And then from there, which I can get more into how this happened, but then from there, I bought 197 unit. That was 3 months later. And then after that, we bought 156 student housing. So it was about 519 beds. And that was like 3 months later. So it just, it's crazy how this all snowballs. And I can get into like how I got into the bigger stuff, but it's just a law of the first deal. It's really true.
Let's dig into kind of that transition from the small stuff, the 3-family or triplex, or whatever you want to call it, to the big stuff. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick sponsor break and we will be right back.
Whether you're trying to hire a full-time employee or a contractor to fill a gap, Hire Tomorrow can help. Hire Tomorrow is a boutique recruitment firm that has successfully filled sales and marketing, human resources, and technology positions with companies ranging from startups to Fortune 500. If you're struggling to find the right talent, check out HireTomorrow.com or reach out to recruiting@HireTomorrow.com to see how they can help.
All right, we are back with Sean Winslow. So before the break, we were talking, Sean was walking us through kind of his transition from starting out with a triplex, or as they say in Boston, a 3-family property. And now he has kind of, it sounds like you've acquired 20-some units in a pretty short amount of time. Before we jump into kind of how you got into the big stuff, for when you were doing these small deals, was that still while you were a W-2 employee? And if so, where did you get the capital to do all these deals? Was it your own, or did you kind of have some partners that you worked with?
Yeah. So I was still a W-2 employee. So, you know, it shows like that you can do it. It's just, you know, you might have to late evenings, weekends, early mornings, but it's easy to do, guys. And then to my point of the law of the first deal earlier, once you get going and build that team, the next deals just flow so much easier from all aspects, right? I'm not saying this is an easy business, but it definitely gets easier as you go because you build up that team. You know what to expect for the most part. You know, real estate definitely throws you wrenches at you all the time. But so the second part of your question, so it was W-2, and then the money wise, the first two deals were me and my partner's money. The third deal we brought in hard money, or private money. The fourth deal was that cash out refi. So we put that into it. And then the 14 unit, we brought in some private investors. And then obviously, once we got into the bigger stuff, we syndicated those.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting when you get into the real estate game and you start peeling back the onion, there's so many creative finance ways that you just have no exposure to in your traditional kind of 9-to-5 or traditional kind of schooling. You know, cash out refis, yeah, if you have a house, you can do some type of a cash out refi, but there's so many cool ways to kind of get started as an active investor, which is what you were doing as a W-2, or even as a passive investor. Obviously, there's other ways to get into it. So talk us through, I guess, the transition from small deals to these larger 100 plus unit deals. And then at what point did you feel comfortable enough that you had the kind of the financial foundation to say, I can actually do this full time and I'm going to jump out and quit my W-2?
Yeah. So I always wanted to do the bigger stuff out of the gate, just because I came from, you know, an institutional background, and I just knew the power of the economies of scale of the bigger stuff. And it just made sense to me, right? Like, not only can you pay for a third party property management, but it also affords on-site staff. And that just made so much sense to me. Plus just being able to scale, you know, when you're doing renovations, you know, obviously you can get deals on higher volumes of product, right? So I knew I wanted to do that, but then back to that point of, well, I couldn't just do it because I was licensed under FINRA. I just couldn't do that. So once I got to the point where I felt I was comfortable enough to have enough cash flow, that's when, you know, I left and made that decision to just go all in. And at that point, I also knew, like, and this is funny because I've never really thought this way before until this moment. And I really can't even tell you why. It might have been just from hearing it on podcasts or books, but
yeah,
I just knew I needed a mentor or someone to guide me. Like, this is a big step, like from investing in, you know, four units and triplexes and duplexes. Even though it makes more sense to go bigger, it's still a different game.
It's a mindset shift, right?
Because
it's like, you almost feel like you're not supposed to do it yet, right? Like, there's a lot of people that, whether it's passive or active, you kind of feel like, let me start with a single family, or let me do a flip, right? Because I'm not ready to do 100 units. And then, you know, you talk to other people and it's like, no, just go big, because to your point, economies of scale, if you go to 100 units, you have on-site staff, you can, you know, utilize different financing and all that fun stuff. So yeah, keep going. I'm kind of curious kind of how that transition happened. And then I guess talk us a little bit about what you're doing now, because obviously, for those of you may or may not know, I was on your podcast. So, you know, you've got a podcast out there, and then just talk us through kind of your, what you're doing now with your firm.
Yeah. So the next step was, I need to find who's going to be this mentor. And it goes back to what I mentioned before, before I decided in real estate, I wanted to build something around my life that fit my life, you know, right? And the life I wanted to live. And so that's the angle I took from with a mentor too. I needed to find someone that was living the life that I wanted and
got it
and doing the things I wanted. I just didn't want to find someone who was just a successful investor. I wanted to find someone who was a successful investor in the stuff I wanted to invest in, and he was had success in his life, in the life that I wanted to create.
Right.
So through, I don't know, networking and podcasts and, you know, get down that podcast and YouTube rabbit hole. Honestly, I probably couldn't even track back how I found this individual, but, you know, I got there. And what I decided to do is I took this from what I used to do in finance. You get someone's attention. Personally, for me, it was handwriting a letter. So everyone gets emails, everyone gets calls, everyone gets DMs on social media, right? So found his address and wrote him a handwritten letter, just saying how, like, appreciated the content that he put out. You know, he's living the life that I aspire to have one day. And I let him know what I could offer. And if there's any way I could help him with anything he needed, I would do it for free. Right. And I sent that letter to him and I got a call. So put my phone number in there for sure. And got a call. And he just laughed because he said that was his move. That's what he does. So it really hit home for him. And yeah. And then he was one of my first mentors and partnered on one of the earlier deals with him. And yeah, it changed the trajectory of my career for sure. Cause I got to not only, cause as you know, Justin, I'm sure you've told the listeners, like, this game is about, like, team and partnerships. Yeah. You're not doing a 200 unit deal by yourself on the first, at least definitely not on the first one, right?
Yeah. Well, and even on the 10th one, you still have to work with lawyers and, you know, brokers and insurance companies. Like, there's, even if you can raise the money and you've got the track record yourself, you still have to partner with other people to execute that deal, right? So
yeah. And to that point, like I, not only did I get him to mentor me, but I got access to his team. So you mentioned the attorneys, you know, well, I found the brokers because that we can get more into that because that's kind of my niche because it that's comes from my background. But yeah, his attorneys, you know, property management, all that good stuff. You know, I got access, construction management, I got access to all of that.
Yeah.
And it's just made the difference.
Yeah, no, and that's finding somebody that is ahead of you is super powerful in a lot of aspects in the real estate game, especially large multi. You need a team to take down these big deals, right? And also it's not only the team, but you need capital, you need to find the deals, you need to have legal draft these documents. So there is a team game kind of associated with large multifamily stuff. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about, we're recording this in kind of mid-February 2023. You know, interest rates are high, inflation is high, you know, fears of recession and all that fun stuff. I guess let's talk a little about your kind of outlook for 2023. Let's talk a little bit about, are you still looking for deals? What's your focus with your own firm? And then we can kind of dig into some other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the question of the year, question of, I guess, the next decade, right? Is what's going to happen? What's the Fed going to do?
Yeah.
What are some other countries going to do? What's, you know, the market going to do in general? And man, it's one of those things that we can't predict. So I think you always got to be looking for deals. So we're still underwriting. We're still building relationships with brokers. And, you know, we're out there hunting for deals and it might be harder. You know, everyone's talking about, you know, this is going to be the time that changes your life, changes your career, because you're going to find deals of this, of like the century. And maybe that will happen, but maybe not. And the reason why it might not happen is because one, we're all going to be hunting for those deals. So are you really going to, unless you go direct the seller, are you really going to be able to scoop it up for a song? You know, that's, you know, we'll see. Right. And I don't think we're really going to see more opportunities present themselves probably until Q3 of this year, just because, yeah, people might be feeling pain right now, but there's a lagging effect to it. Right. Like they'll take the pain at the beginning because they're not just going to throw in the towel. They want to get through this and obviously try not to have a blemish, you know, on their track record. So they're going to do whatever they can. But then there's going to be a point where it's just too much pain. And either they're just going to have to get out or their investors are going to make them get out. And I don't think we're at that point yet.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of, you know, and I'm not an economist by any sense. So don't take this like it's written in stone. But a lot of indicators point towards, you know, something coming in the April, May timeframe. And so we'll see if that happens, right? But I think the Fed's going to do what they were saying, right? There's probably going to be another 25 basis point hike. This is what the forward yield curve has predicted anyways. And then they'll kind of just, you know, hang steady for the remainder of the year. And then in 2024, the forward curve predicts that they'll taper back, you know, so they'll take the foot off the gas and lower the rates. But to answer that, the beginning of that question is, yeah, we're still looking for deals 100%.
Yeah. And right now, like, you know, I've even seen it, you know, so far this year, you know, I've had a few brokers reach out to me directly, and I think they're going to have to do a little bit more work when they do have deals, because there are going to be, I think there are a lot of buyers that are on the sidelines, because I think 2023 is kind of what I've been saying is it's like the year of the operator. So if you bought deals in the last year or two and you're on variable rate debt and maybe you didn't buy a rate cap because nobody anticipated rates going up as high as they have and definitely not as fast as they have, you're going to be really hyper-focused on operating your current portfolio, whether it's one or 20 or 30 properties, right? Because, you know, you may have had to pause distribution, so your investors are a little bit more anxious. So, you know, I've talked to a couple of people in the group that I'm in that have acquired deals, and I was like, hey, are you guys still looking? They're like, no, like they're not even like, they're telling brokers like, hey, I'm on the sidelines for right now, because they are hyper-focused on making sure that the deals that they do have are performing as best as they possibly can. And once they get those kind of stabilized and maybe we are into that kind of Q2, Q3, Q4 timeframe, then they'll start to pick their heads up. But I've had brokers reach out to me and say, hey, I have this deal. Can you just write an offer? Because the seller is not realistic in what their sale price expectations are, right? So I think there's still some balancing that's going on between what sellers think they can get for their property and also what brokers are communicating, right? Because you know, the market shows what the price or what the property is worth. So
yeah,
I think it's going to be interesting. I'm still actively looking at deals. I guess, are there specific markets that you're targeting now or maybe avoiding now, given that maybe there's some different things happening in those markets that you're kind of either more attracted to or less attracted to?
Yeah. Before I get into that, to add on to the point you said, that's one of the main reasons I'm still looking at deals. It's not because I may think I'm going to find something. Yeah, there's the potential I could. So that's also a reason. But the main reason is to continue the relationship building with the brokers.
Yeah.
And so once deals start to come, they remember that I was there through thick and thin. And also I'll just be top of mind because we've been talking this whole time. So I will not tell a broker I'm not buying. I tell them I'm always buying for the right deal.
Yeah.
And, but to those, to the point of your colleagues, yeah, we're focused on the operation side too, for sure. Cause that's, this is the time, should always be focused, but this is the time where you really need to be focused, make sure everything's tight, you know, not overspending on anything. So I do agree with that. To answer your question about markets, we haven't really changed per se. So again, when I first started, it was in the Northeast. And then we started syndicating, we stopped looking in the Northeast. So the only thing that's changed is now we're looking in the Northeast again. And we'll look for some smaller stuff just because we are here, boots on the ground. We have relationships. Yeah. We know the markets. I have relationships with banks, with local lenders. And I think this is the time where those really shine. So that's why we're looking in this area. And some of these areas I just know really well. And I know they're, you know, recession, not resistant, but resilient. And so we're looking here, but we're also looking at our other target markets, which are North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. So we look at obviously the major demographic points, right? So you like population growth, household income growth, household value growth, job growth, you know, a low crime rate. And one of the things we look at a lot too, from the population growth standpoint, is U-Haul data. So U-Haul obviously is a publicly traded company. Yep. So they put out quarterly reports. So we'll look at where is that net migration. And those three states I mentioned are always, in the last couple of years, have been in the top 10, if not top five. So yeah, obviously there's some other big hitters out there like Florida and Texas where you're at. So that's kind of the stuff we look at. So we're still Carolinas, Georgia, in the Northeast. Specifically in the Northeast, we like New Hampshire because it's landlord friendly. Whereas Massachusetts, Rhode Island,
definitely not.
Maine, New York, they're not. Yeah, correct. Yeah.
No, that's fair.
Correct.
So I want to kind of transition to kind of the final parts of the pod. And you know, my audience is the traditional, I'm a 9-to-5er. I love my job. I make a lot of money, but I want different options, right? Outside of the traditional 401k or the stock market, because they want to, you know, maybe generate some additional passive income, or they just want a couple of different like options for investing. So, you know, put yourself back in your W-2 days and, you know, what would you kind of give somebody, what advice would you give them, you know, as a good first step if they want to start a passive real estate investing journey? Obviously, listening to this podcast is probably a good step, but what do you think is a good kind of step for them to kind of get more comfortable in, you know, investing in these deals?
Yeah. First is, yeah, definitely listen to this podcast because Justin's a rock star and I know he's going to bring on rock stars too. So my point of earlier of mentors, like, a mentor doesn't have to be something formal like I did. It can be a podcast. It can be YouTube channel, a book, right? That's a great way to start. And then once you really get into it, to me, it's more about if I was a limited partner, like from my standpoint, we're general partners. So the underwriting comes the market and deal level. And we do a lot of hours and hours of work on that per deal, right? But from a limited partner, I'm more concerned about the due diligence and the underwriting on the operators, the general partner themselves.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the deal, because if you can trust the operator, and when I say operator and general partner, it's the same thing, and you can trust the operator, you know they're going to then present you a solid deal, right? And, you know, if you don't trust them, anyone can show you a deal that looks good, right? This is just numbers. Like,
it's Excel.
You can make it look good. And when people ask me about underwriting, the first thing I say is, you know, what the whole thing about underwriting is trying to kill the deal. If you can kill it, and especially if you can kill it pretty easily, move on.
Yeah.
If you can't kill it, then I bet you have a deal. And so that's just my point of like, anyone can flub those numbers. I can get emotionally attached and make it look good. So it's more about really finding out who that operator is, you know, ask for their track record. And if they're starting out, that doesn't mean that's a no-go, right? Like, who are they partnered with that has a track record?
Right.
And who is that person? And what are their morals? What do they stand for? Ask them, like, when has something gone wrong and what did you do? Like, you know, if something happened, like, are you more worried about providing a return or protecting the investor's hard-earned money? And,
yeah.
And, you know, for some people, the answer could go either way. But if you know who you are, you want to make sure you get that right answer because you want to be aligned. Like, there's operators out there that have different goals and you just want to make sure you're aligned.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And to your point about being emotionally attached to properties, I remember when I was first starting to underwrite deals, you try to make a deal work because you're like, oh, this deal looks awesome. You know, it's in a great location. And you're just like, oh yeah, it should work, right? It should be great, but you just can't make it work. And it's like, you learn very quickly to not waste your time on the emotional side of trying to find a deal. So that's a good point.
Yeah, you got to set up that buy box, you know? And
yeah.
If it hits, move on. If it doesn't, then just throw that away and on to the next.
Yeah, and be super rigid and just be like, hey, if it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit. I'm on to the next one. Don't waste time. So, all right, let's transition to the kind of final phase here. I've got a 3-pack of questions I ask every guest. So let's jump into the first one. What's one piece of advice that you got when you started or has helped you on your real estate investing journey?
Yeah, it's probably just to think bigger. Don't think always so small. Like, and it was kind of a twofold advice there. It was think bigger. And like, if you're comfortable, one, you're not thinking big enough. And two, you're not going to grow.
Yeah.
So if you're uncomfortable, you're doing the right thing. And that changed everything for me because, you know, when I first started, it was like, you know, a big deal is anything from 75 units and upwards. So at first, you know, I was looking at like the 75 to 100. And then my first big deal ended up being just under 200, right? So
yeah.
I opened my eyes and, you know, when brokers would first send you deals, you'd get nervous, like, is this too big? Should I be doing this? And then it just turned into like, no, I just need to get this, make sure it's a deal. And then two, I need to get it locked up. And I have parts and pieces and the team to make this work.
Yeah.
And that just changed everything for me.
It takes the same amount of effort to underwrite a 75 unit deal as it does a 275 unit deal. It's just a matter of, do you have the capital behind you to take down a big deal? That's really the biggest challenge. Awesome. What's your favorite business or real estate book that you're into right now?
Ooh, that I'm into right now. That's a great question. Real estate or business book that I'm into right now. Well, mind if I give two? This might be cheating, but I'll give two. From a real estate book, it's called The Real Estate Game. Purview is his last name is Purview. He was a real estate investor out of Boston, and he was also Harvard Business School professor that he taught real estate. And it's just a solid, really good book, you know, and he's able to explain it just in like layman terms that just makes sense. So I would check that book out. And then in terms of a business book, E-Myth, I've always loved the E-Myth.
Oh, yeah. Great book.
Talks about systems, you know, and working not in your business, but on your business.
Yeah, it's a great book for anybody that's like interested in starting a business or anything like that. It's definitely opened my eyes as I started my entrepreneurial journey for sure. So, all right, last question here. If you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you can live an amazing life just off of passive income from your investments, what would you do?
So I don't know if I'll ever hit the number just because I feel like if I hit it, it'll be a new number, right?
And it'll be more.
And it's not because I want more or need more. It's more because of the game. It just keeps me alive, right? And
yeah,
I think I'll just be pushing for more. Obviously not for the number or the money, but just to feel like I'm actually doing something that, you know, bring purpose to my life, right?
You're not going to sit on a beach for the next 30 years.
Yeah, that's just not me. I think I'd get bored. Like, I go on vacation sometimes that are those style and like bored and want to go do something. So,
yeah,
it'll definitely get to a point where I'll probably peel back a little bit and have more time, right? You know, I like to travel, I like skiing. Yeah. And I like giving back. Like, I want to, you know, our company, Greenbrier Capital Group, part of our mission is to give back a minimum of 10% of profit every year to causes that mean something to us. So, like, the Underground Railroad Project, if you're not familiar with that, they combat, you know, human trafficking.
Oh, interesting.
So that's one. Children hunger. And my partner, his wife's side of the family from Venezuela. And so we want to kind of create a foundation there to help people get out of that area. So that's probably stuff I'll focus more on, you know, as I hit a certain number.
Yeah. No, it's brilliant. I really resonate with that for sure. So yeah, man, thanks for being on the show. How can people kind of get in touch with you? You mentioned your company, Greenbrier Capital, but what's a good way to reach out if they're interested in learning about some of the deals you're working on?
Yeah. So if you want to check out the website, it's greenbriercg.com. And then if you want to get in contact with me, the two best ways to do that are either on Instagram. That's Sean Wins, REI, Sean spelled S-H-A-W-N. Or you can find me on LinkedIn. That's the other best place to find me, Sean Winslow on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll have all this stuff in the show notes, listeners, so you don't have to jot down notes if you're driving. Hopefully you're not driving and texting. So Sean, man, thank you for being on the show. This has been a lot of fun. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Justin, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Awesome. I hope everybody took something away from this episode. And I've got another one dropping pretty soon. So keep listening. And remember, you don't have to quit your career just to build a passive real estate investment portfolio with multiple streams of income. You just need to take some action. And listening to this podcast is a great first step. So thanks for being on, and we'll see you soon.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.